Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Still no concession. Despite repeatedly losing court challenges to election results, President Trump continues to deny his defeat. Then, fired. The president terminates the leader of the top U.S. cybersecurity agency following his rejection of claims the election was compromised. And the recount continues. With Senate runoffs approaching and political pressure increasing, officials in Georgia carry out the painstaking task of retabulating the votes. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The nation tonight has passed 250,000 dead from the coronavirus. The number is rising by an average of 1,100 every day, with roughly 160,000 new infections daily. And President-elect Joe Biden warned today that a potential vaccination campaign is in jeopardy because the Trump administration will not start the transition of power.
There's a whole lot of things that are just we just don't have available to us. Which, unless it's made available soon, we're going to be behind by weeks or months being able to put together the whole initiative relating to the biggest promise we have.
The wave of COVID-19 infections prompted New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio today to close the nation's largest public school system again. Effective tomorrow, more than 1 million students go back to online learning only. President Trump is mounting still more challenges to his election loss to Mr. Biden. The Trump campaign asked today for recounts in two counties in Wisconsin. Meanwhile, Michigan certified its statewide results after Republican canvassers in Detroit initially refused to certify. That drew fire today from Detroit's Democratic mayor.
American democracy cracked last night, but it didn't break. But we are seeing a real threat to everything we believe in. What you are seeing in this country right now is an effort to say we only want to count the votes of people who agree with us.
President-elect Biden won Michigan and Wisconsin, plus Georgia, which is due to finish a hand recount of its votes tonight. We'll return to all of this after the news summary. The United States has imposed another round of sanctions on Iran. Today's announcement targeted the intelligence minister and a charity that is allegedly a regime slush fund. That came as a UN agency reported that centrifuges at Iran's Natanz nuclear site are now enriching uranium. It's been reported that President Trump sought options last week for a military strike on Natanz. Reports of heavy damage and deaths are now coming in from Central America in the wake of Hurricane Iota. Nicaragua today raised its official death toll to 16. Homes were left in ruins along the country's Caribbean coast, and downpours triggered heavy flooding and landslides there and in Honduras.
A hurricane came. It knocked over my house, my daughter's house. It knocked over 5 houses in total, so I'm homeless. Where am I going to live? I have to take care of so many young men. I don't know where I'm going to live.
The hurricane smashed ashore Monday night in the same area where another Category 4 storm hit 2 weeks earlier. Back in this country, a federal judge in Washington ordered the Trump administration today to stop deporting migrant children who crossed the U.S.-Mexico border alone. Nearly 9,000 unaccompanied children have been expelled since March. The administration has used an emergency measure, citing the pandemic as justification. The Federal Aviation Administration has cleared Boeing 737 MAX jetliners to resume deliveries and passenger flights for U.S. airlines. That ends a 20-month ban after 2 crashes that killed 346 people. Today's order calls for Boeing to update key software and computers and for pilots to receive new training. And on Wall Street today, worries about surging COVID-19 infections outweighed optimism about new vaccines. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 345 points to close at 29,438. The Nasdaq fell 97 points, and the S&P 500 slid 41. Still to come on the NewsHour, despite repeatedly losing court challenges to election results, President Trump continues to deny his defeat. The leader of the top U.S. cybersecurity agency is fired following his rejection of claims that the election was compromised. Election officials in Georgia carry out the painstaking task of recounting the votes, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The next president is set to be sworn in 9 weeks from today, although the Associated Press and all other news major outlets say that that will be Joe Biden. President Trump and his allies continue to contest the results. Yamiche Alcindor and Lisa Desjardins are here with the latest. Hello to both of you. So, Yamiche, to you first. We are now more than 2 weeks since Election Day. The president, as we've been reporting, still insists that he has not lost. He is continuing to mount these challenges. What do we know right now?
Well, the president is continuing his long-shot bid to wrestle back this election somehow from President-elect Joe Biden. And today, that wrestling back took the form of a partial recount. The Trump campaign is demanding a $3 million partial recount in Wisconsin. It's focusing on two specific counties, Dane County and Milwaukee County. That's important because critics say that these are Democratic strongholds that are not going to at all be overturned, even if you recount the votes. Now, the Trump campaign could have asked for an $8 million statewide recount, but they're not doing that, saving some of that money. But they do want to show that they are still in this fight. Campaign sources say that the president feels like he can still win this election, but critics say this is really theatrics and nothing more. Now, the Trump campaign, as you noted, is continuing to mount legal challenges and continuing to have lawsuits go in a number of states, including in Nevada, in Pennsylvania, in Georgia, and similar arguments being made that there's massive voter fraud. Again, no evidence of that. Another thing to note, though, is this shifting rhetoric that we continue to see happening with those close to President Trump. Today, the White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, he went to Capitol Hill, spoke to senators. Senators described that as a mixed message, a goodbye message in some thought, but also a message to say fight on. He said, in part, on President Trump's term, it could be 45 days or 4 years and 45 days. Now, take that and add that with Trump campaign sources telling me that the mood inside the Trump campaign is demoralized. People feeling like the president is at this point a sore loser and feeling like it's a long shot bid and almost impossible for him to win this.
So, meantime, Lisa, at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, the Democrats in the House of Representatives gathered today. They know they are going to be looking at a smaller majority in January. What did they decide? What are they doing?
Right. Eclipsed by all of the attention, understandably, on the presidential race are some really interesting changes happening in the House. Something that's not changing, who will be leading House Democrats. Today, House Democrats voted by voice acclamation in their private meeting that Nancy Pelosi would retain the speakership. Now, she still needs 218 votes in January. We'll get there later, Judy, but Democrats have said she will be their leader. The top three leadership positions, in fact, are unchanged for right now. But the fact of the matter is something is different for House Democrats, something dramatic. Their margin is going to be smaller coming into it. Let's look at where the House balance of power stands right now. Here's that fan graphic I love to show. Amna and I were talking about on election night so much. Right now, Democrats have 220 seats, won in this year's election. Of course, a majority in the House is 218 seats. There are 11 seats still uncalled. Now, Republicans lead in about three or four, depending on how you want to look at it, that they could take from Democrats. And in fact, there's some fascinating races in Iowa. A 400,000 voter race, down to 47 votes. But the point here is that Democrats have some things that they need to focus on for next year. One, when you talk about House Democrats, they will have fewer moderates, a smaller margin. Pelosi has said that that agenda won't change for them because of it. But when you talk behind the scenes, you know there's unity on a few things, infrastructure, voting rights for Democrats. But this smaller margin could spell problems for other agenda items like climate and spending, Judy. It is going to be difficult for Democrats in some instances to stay unified, but so far, Speaker Pelosi has done it better than anyone.
And Lisa, it's natural for them to be focusing on next year, but they still have time this year to get some things done. What are they saying about that?
There is one major priority that must get done, that is keeping government funded. The deadline for that is December 11th. So that might seem like it's a few weeks away, but actually, Congress is leaving for Thanksgiving break today and tomorrow, and they will not be able to address that in the meantime. So when they come back, they'll have just 2 weeks to deal with that December 11th funding deadline. And there is some good news. Democrats and Republicans are getting closer to a deal amongst themselves. But Judy, I have to tell you, both parties and both sides of the Capitol told me today they're worried about President Trump. He needs to sign any funding deal or even just an extension of funding. And of course, you remember the last time power changed hands in 2018, Democrats came into the House with that election. We had the longest government shutdown in history because President Trump would not get on board.
We remember it well. Lisa Desjardins, Yamiche Alcindor, no shortage of things to cover. Well after this election. Thank you both. The turnover of people in the Trump administration continues and again raises some troubling questions. The latest, President Trump firing the top cybersecurity official at the Department of Homeland Security, Christopher Krebs. It comes after Krebs, whose job it was to secure U.S. election systems, pushed back on false claims of fraud. William Brangham reports.
This new agency will ensure that we confront the full range of threats from nation states, cyber criminals, and other malicious actors, of which there are many.
In 2018, President Trump signed legislation to fund the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, known as CISA, within the Department of Homeland Security. Its goal: to protect critical infrastructure, including the nation's election systems. The president named cybersecurity expert Christopher Krebs to be its director. Krebs had been serving within DHS at the time. Last month, just days before the election, Krebs told the NewsHour that CISA had come a long way.
We've just made remarkable progress. The evidence supports that. The security of these systems has improved, but most importantly, the resilience of the system has dramatically improved.
The consensus among elections officials and agencies across the government is that despite ongoing threats of disinformation, foreign interference, plus the pandemic, the 2020 election was the most secure in U.S. history.
Director Krebs deserves an enormous amount of credit for his efforts, for his leadership in this space.
Ben Hovland is chairman of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. He, too, was nominated by President Trump. Hovland's commission studies and helps disseminate election system best practices.
One of the things that makes working on election issues difficult from the national level is the decentralized nature of our elections. And Director Krebs, I think, did a great job empowering his team to recognize that the 50 states each run elections in their own unique way. And so it was important to listen, to hear what their needs were and try to provide that.
Dmitry Alperovich is a co-founder of the cybersecurity company CrowdStrike. He worked with Krebs to improve the capabilities of local election officials to detect and withstand cyber attacks.
Well, one of the things that Chris was very passionate about is getting instrumentation in state systems and local municipalities that are running actually these election systems so that we would know if they're being attacked by foreign actors or domestic actors. And we worked very hard in the private sector to help him gain that level of instrumentation so he would know, and the rest of the federal government would know, if those systems are being attacked and would be able to respond accordingly.
Most Republicans on Capitol Hill chose not to comment on Krebs' firing, but a notable few were critical. Here's GOP Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois on CNN.
Chris Krebs said the election was secure. That's his job to say that. His job is to make sure that they're defending the elections. And of course, that is counter to what the president is trying to say. So I think that all feeds into why he's out there. And, you know, there's like a loyalty purge going on in the last month in the White House.
And Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn.
It's a president's prerogative, but I think it just adds to the confusion and chaos. But we know that there were people that tried to influence the election. And the irony is we've really done a much better job in 2018 and 2020.
Many believe Krebs was fired because of his agency's continuing effort to push back on false claims and rumors surrounding the election, some of which were created or repeated by President Trump. To fight disinformation, CISA ran this website called Rumor Control, batting down myths and lies about things like computer hacking or duplicate ballots or compromised voter rolls. But it was this joint statement put out by CISA 6 days ago that seemed to seal his fate. It read, "The November 3rd election was the most secure in American history." And later, in bold, directly contradicting the president and his lawyers, it read, "There is no evidence that any voting system deleted or lost votes, changed votes, or was in any way compromised." Last night, the president tweeted, "The recent statement by Chris Krebs on the security of the 2020 election was highly inaccurate. Therefore, effective immediately, Chris Krebs has been terminated." So now, for a much broader look at this moment, both for the president and for the country, I'm joined now by Ron Suskind. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and reporter. Ron, great to have you back on the NewsHour.
Great to be here, William.
You have been covering this president since the get-go. We have now seen Christopher Krebs fired. We've seen the leadership at the Pentagon lopped off and replaced. Help us understand how we ought to be seeing these events.
What you're seeing here is Trump executing his loyalty test that really has been active since around early 2018, where he really realized in a moment of clarity that loyalty was his key word. He had lots of officials who would not take an oath of personal loyalty to him. They took an oath to the Constitution. Trump accepted them at the beginning and then said, "I got to get rid of all of them." Krebs and others and Esper are almost the last of that array of officials that were once populating different parts of the government that would not take this oath of loyalty to Trump and Trump's interests, however he defines them.
You recently wrote a terrific piece in the New York Times opinion piece that was based on a lot of deep reporting with several dozen former and current high-level administration officials. And the concern expressed was what happens after the election. And many of the things that you reported they worried about have come to pass, sort of refusal to concede, allegations of fraud, lawsuits. I know you have continued to talk with many of those same people. What is it that they're worried about happening from this point forward?
Well, they William, really saw this period between the election and the inauguration as arguably the most dangerous time. And what they're specifically fearful of, most pointedly, is Trump activating his loyalists. Remember, he has an enormous army, if you will, of people deeply committed to him in a way that I don't think we've seen in modern political history, especially a core of the core, maybe half of the half. That's where much of their concern is focused. Trump has not been back meeting with them since the election. It's almost like lovers separated from one another. He will at some point, no one doubts that. And at which point you're going to see the nature of power that he possesses outside of that the Article II powers of the Constitution give him until the 20th of January. That community is in a way waiting for direction from their leader, for whom they have really a deep bond and a love.
So let's talk a little bit about specifically how that might play out. I mean, you've got the powers of the presidency and you've got the powers of a devoted base of followers. How do the people you're talking to, and again, these are military, intelligence, administration people, how does that play out in a way that troubles them?
Well, you know, think of it as a left hand and a right hand. With his right hand, he has the powers of the government. That means federal forces to quell demonstrations. That means bringing law and order and maybe even activating National Guards in various states, Article II powers. On the other hand, he has real direction over an enormous array of people who might be at the source of a significant amount of chaos, demonstrations, protests, and all sorts of things that really may change the landscape of states. For instance, if Trump goes out, as people are expecting, to do stadium shows in the next couple weeks, 100,000 people, 50,000 people cheering, whipped into a frenzy by their leader, who then has the option to say, either I will cut you loose or I'll tell you to stand by or stand down and stand by. That's an enormous amount of power he retains.
Devil's advocate here. I hear all the concerns you're expressing and that these people are expressing, but is it possible that we're not seeing something larger going on, that this could simply be the tail end of an administration headed by a man who simply doesn't want to get up power? He's firing some people, and that it may not end up being anything more than just that.
It could be. But one thing that I think is important to keep focused on is that those folks deeply committed to Donald Trump, some portion of that 72 million who voted for him, he is taking that with him. He's not giving them up. We could be in a situation where the Biden presidency is in a day-to-day conflict for ratings with a man who I would not fight on a ratings landscape in any day. I would not wish that on my worst enemy. He is a master of that terrain. That's what I think is going to be so interesting, and maybe what's frankly so unsettling about the years that we certainly will have ahead of us. What will Trump do with the power he's already accrued and is likely not to be giving up? All those people who say, he's my guy, and I don't see anyone necessarily replacing him in the Republican array. He's got a special bond that he's developed with them. And I don't see anybody essentially taking that from him. It's his to own and his to use. How will he use it? That's what we're all watching.
All right. Ron Susskind, always good to have you. Thank you very much.
Great to be with you, William.
As President Trump presses forward with those legal challenges and false claims that he won the election, Georgia has been the center of national attention with its statewide recount. The deadline for finishing the recount is midnight tonight, and President-elect Biden's advantage and apparent win of the state is holding. Miles O'Brien reports on the largest hand recount in U.S. history.
Biden.
Biden.
Barely more exciting than watching paint dry. The manual audit of every ballot cast for president in Georgia on November 3rd methodically marches forward despite a harsh intramural political feud.
Emotions are high. The president's going to continue to fight. His supporters continue to fight.
Gabe Sterling runs elections for Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. Both are dyed in crimson wool Republicans, fending off an elephant's helping of wrath from President Trump and several other party comrades, all of them questioning the integrity of the contest that made Joe Biden a whisker-thin winner here.
There's a lot of stuff flying around on Twitter and Facebook that is, you know, touches fact, but doesn't necessarily have all the facts or the evidence, and that's what we're trying to get to.
It's an arduous path that began with a pre-election plan to conduct a scientifically random check of the state's new $106 million voting system. It's called a risk-limiting audit, or RLA.
An RLA is designed to determine whether the winner won without any chance of a machine problem happening.
Monica Childers is with a nonprofit called Voting Works, hired by the state. We first met her in September in Brunswick, Georgia, as she schooled election officials on how to run these audits. If there is ample cushion in the margin between candidates, RLAs can validate the outcome of an election with great confidence by checking only a small sample of ballots. But no such luck in this race, separated by less than a third of a percentage point.
When you do a risk-limiting audit on a race with a very small margin, your sample size is going to expand because the margin is what determines how many ballots you have to look at. So our margin in the presidential race was very, very small, and that's why we're looking at all the ballots.
Nearly 5 million of them. It is the largest hand count of ballots in U.S. history, and it appears to be going pretty smoothly. The Atlanta-based Carter Center deployed a veteran team of observers who earned their spurs watching sketchy elections run by despots all over the world. It is their first domestic assignment, a sad sign of the times. Paige Alexander is the CEO.
I believe that we're in a place where each side has riled up the other, and we're not going to get over it easily without people listening to each other. And so as long as you can shed a light on it and you can show people how the process works and people are willing to listen, then, you know, there's hope.
But listening may be a lost art in this age of partisan hyperpolarity. First, the state's senators, both Republicans, demanded Raffensperger resign, citing unspecified failures. Then outgoing Republican Congressman Doug Collins accused Raffensperger of caving in to Democratic pressure. And President Trump called him a so-called Republican and then made baseless claims the state didn't properly verify signatures on mail-in ballots. That issue prompted Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina to call the secretary. On CNN, he was asked exactly what Graham said.
Well, he asked if the ballots could be matched back to the voters. And then I got the sense it implied that then you could throw those out.
Senator Graham denies he asked that votes be tossed. Meanwhile, election workers counting ballots found some fuel for the fire. In three red counties, they found about 5,500 ballots that had not been scanned or uploaded. It reduced Biden's margin of victory by about 1,200 to just shy of 13,000.
We have seen nothing that indicates that there is a high percentage, or such a high percentage, that it would change the outcome of the vote. Our goal is to have the cleanest possible election.
In the trenches of this epic ballot count, the assignment to deliver on that promise falls to election directors like Christy Royston in Gwinnett County, an Atlanta exurb.
Are you exhausted?
You know, I'm tired, but I really think when it comes to this, some sort of adrenaline kicks in.
True to her profession, she is a process-loving perfectionist and proud of it.
So all this paper, going back and forth, folders, batches, nothing gets lost?
We have really good tracking systems. It's check and recheck and then document it so that we can go back and see where we are.
She doesn't mind the scrutiny, but is growing weary of the accusations.
Is it rigged?
I do not believe it's rigged. I've been doing this for 23 years, and for what the checks and balances and the security, you know, I trust the system. Things are worth questioning. Things are worth making sure that there's accuracy in it. But, you know, I do think that sometimes you have to have faith and trust in the process and the people who are running it.
So there is more work ahead, Judy. While this audit verifies the outcome, it does not carry the legal authority to change the actual final tallies. After the state certifies the election, and that's supposed to happen on Friday, the Trump campaign has 2 business days, that puts it into Tuesday of next week, to request a formal recount. And that would be a rescan of the ballots, and that would put those election workers at work going into the Thanksgiving holiday because the margin here is so close, Judy.
Just fascinating, Miles, taking us inside that process. So, Miles, one of the many other areas of your interest and expertise as a reporter is aviation. So I have some questions about that. Today we know the FAA has cleared the Boeing 737 MAX to fly again. Right now, we have one airline saying it may be ready to do that by the end of December. Other airlines saying it may take more months than that. What will it take for these airlines to be comfortable flying this plane that has had problems in the past?
Yeah, for the airlines and the regulators, Judy, they've got a fair amount of work to do. And that's why you're not seeing this happening instantly. There is a 115-page airworthiness directive, which is kind of the law of the land for the FAA, which gives a whole series of changes to the aircraft. There will be two so-called angle of attack sensors feeding in to the computer system, which has that piece of software designed to keep the aircraft from flying too far nose high and stalling, which was at the root of those two crashes. There will be a whole bunch of maintenance to be done because after all, these aircraft have been sitting now for 20 months on the ground in desert locations primarily. And then there's an entire training regime that each airline has to come up with for its pilots, who initially in the original days didn't know anything about this system, which was the problem. So there's a fair amount of work ahead. American will go first. Then you're going to see United and then Southwest.
And meantime, Miles, we are hearing from some family members of those who perished in those crashes say they are concerned that this maybe is moving too fast. They're raising questions about whether the culture that allowed this to happen may not have changed enough.
Yeah, it's hard to change culture at huge organizations of any kind, and in particularly complex systems like you see with aircraft manufacturing such as Boeing. But I did speak with one of the attorneys representing some of these families, Mary Schiavo, just a little while ago. And the families are very upset about the fact that despite all the public relations side of this and what Boeing is presenting to the general public, the attorneys are still trying to blame the pilots for those two crashes, not accepting any blame on the part of the corporation, on the part of Boeing for the crashes. That might be a good legal position, but it leaves the families very upset about what's happening right now. And they're expressing great concerns about the safety of the aircraft.
And finally, Miles, FAA today saying anything about not grounding the 737 MAX after the first fatal accident?
Yeah, this has been the biggest tragedy to me. After that first accident, you knew you had a system-wide problem that had catastrophic consequences, and the FAA chose not to ground the aircraft. Today, the FAA Administrator, Stephen Dixon, told me, and he's actually flown the MAX, the improved 737 MAX. He's an airline captain. He said, yes, in retrospect, they probably should have done that, but he says at the time they didn't have enough information. He made a pitch, and this is an important thing, that as time goes on and there are more regulations which require streaming of data from aircraft, we will have the kind of information we need to make these decisions more quickly in the future. And that's something to push for in the future, Judy.
All right, Miles O'Brien on two major stories today. Thank you, Miles.
Welcome, Judy.
As we've been reporting, the coronavirus is showing no signs of slowing down or allowing lives to go back to normal as Americans prepare for the holiday season. Thanksgiving is just a week away, and millions will be gathering in new ways. There have been a number of warnings and caveats given about how to approach the holiday. Amna Nawaz is here to get more insight about what we should keep in mind.
Judy, health officials have been warning that other holiday gatherings during the pandemic have been followed by spikes in new COVID cases. Still, a national survey by Ohio State found that nearly 2 in 5 Americans said they will likely attend a Thanksgiving gathering with more than 10 people. Here with more information on what you should consider before making your plans is Dr. Ranit Mishori. She's a professor of family medicine at Georgetown University School of Medicine and senior medical advisor for Physicians for Human Rights. Dr. Mishori, welcome back to the NewsHour, and thanks for taking the time to answer these questions. Now, people are hearing this 10 number from officials, try to limit your gatherings to 10 people. Some people say, look, we've been quarantining. Maybe some have even tested negative. What's wrong with gathering with a bigger group this holiday? What do you say to those people?
Well, I think, unfortunately, there's the only way to prevent the transmission of the virus is by limiting the number of people you interact with. 10 is a sort of a random number that people came up with, but the smaller the number, the better. Part of it is that people are traveling in order to link up with their family members, to see their friends. And the travel is a very problematic issue. You can bring disease from counties and states where the epidemic is raging. Even if you don't have symptoms, we know that a lot of people can be asymptomatic. You bring it to your small household, small community, and it's enough to have one person who is infected to infect a whole host of other people. The number 10 really is just, I think, a proxy to say, limit the number of people. 10 people in a small apartment or a small house is could be very, very problematic. So don't focus on the number 10.
You mentioned travel. So what about that? College students will want to go home. People who maybe live alone in cities will want to see families. What should people consider and answer for themselves before deciding whether to hit the road or whether just to stay in place?
I think the best advice I can give anybody and everybody, including my own family members, is not to travel. We've made the tough decision for my daughter to not come to our home for this holiday, and for us to not see other family members and just keep to ourselves. It's a sacrifice, but everybody has to make a sacrifice so then that the disease does not spread, and then winter and certainly the Christmas holiday could look much worse. So if you decide to travel, and again, I can't emphasize enough how much I would recommend not traveling at all, I think you need to consider look at the testing protocols for the in the state that you're traveling to. Think about your mode of transportation. Driving is safer than flying, than taking a bus or than taking a train where you're cramped together with a lot of people. Of course, you need to think about quarantining before leaving, so to make sure that you don't have exposures yourself that you can then develop the disease and move on and go on to infecting the people that you're visiting. And of course, taking all of the public health measures, wearing a mask at all times, wearing it correctly over your nose and your mouth, washing your hands and keeping at least 6 feet apart from anyone else that you come in contact with. And that's very, very important. The distancing is incredibly important.
What about best practices for those who are gathering in whatever small number that they are? Should they wear masks when not eating? Should they increase ventilation? Should they space out seating? How do you make it a safer plan this year?
The best way to do it, I think, would be, number one, if you can have your meal outdoors, and I know some places are going to be very cold, do it outdoors if you can. If you have to do it indoors, space yourselves at least 6 feet apart from one another. Wear a mask indoors with anyone who's not a member of your household. Ask everybody to bring their own food items, to bring their own utensils. Do not share utensils. Don't eat off of a buffet-style type of setting, and try to sit apart as much as possible, especially if everybody brings their own plate, their own meal. I think that would be safer. Ventilate, ventilate, ventilate. Open the windows, open the doors. Take a break, go outside, come back in. Don't stay seated in a small, unventilated room for long periods of time.
It'll be a holiday unlike any we've seen, but hopefully a safe one for everyone out there. Dr. Ranit Mishori, thank you so much for taking the time to answer these questions.
Thank you so much.
German prosecutors today ask for life imprisonment for a right-wing extremist charged with killing two people last year outside a synagogue in Germany's east. That comes as calls grow to investigate the extent of neo-Nazi infiltration of the country's security services. 1,400 cases of far-right extremism among soldiers, police officers, and intelligence agents have been documented over the past 3 years, a frightening echo of Germany's past. From Berlin, special correspondent Malcolm Brabant reports.
Back to the future in a bleak East Berlin suburb. Right-wingers marked 30 years of German reunification with a rally ripe with 1930s attitudes. Up went a chant from a banned neo-Nazi song predicting ultimate victory.
Frei, sozial und national.
This group has sprung from an outlawed extremist party, the Third Path, that shares ideology with similar European groups. Its logo contains a nod to Hitler's Third Reich.
The last 3 to 4 years have clearly shown that multiculturalism has failed, and it's our job to end it. We have to rely on our own people for our future, for the safety of our children and grandchildren.
The command, advance on Berlin. Alarm bells are ringing about the far-right surge. These protesters wanted to confront the neo-Nazis. The police kept them apart as an anti-fascist anthem played. Militaristic displays are outlawed in Germany. The police ordered them not to march, but to, quote, saunter casually. The instruction was ignored. These people are some of the most extreme neo-Nazis in Germany, and there are many groups like this. But what the authorities are worried about is not these people so much who are out in public, it's those neo-Nazis who are hiding in the establishment in the shadows. This video by the Bundeswehr, the German military, eulogizes the prowess of an elite special forces unit called the KSK. But today, it's in disgrace. One company has been disbanded because of a right-wing extremist culture. A cache of weapons, ammunition and explosives was found buried at the home of one soldier.
If you're looking for a special unit who could take over the German chancellery or the most important ministries within Berlin, then this was the most important unit to do so.
Timo Reinfrank's mission is to counter right-wing violence. He heads a foundation named after Amadeo Antonio, an Angolan immigrant murdered by extremists in 1990. Reinfrank worries that neo-Nazis have infiltrated other branches of the German military.
The problem about the army is that we don't know anything. This is a more or less closed shop that we only hear in the public from special incidents. But we know that the majority of the right-wing scene is full of trained people from the German Bundeswehr.
These concerns are shared by Germany's highest echelons. Last month's celebrations, muted by COVID-19, were supposed to toast the 30-year-long marriage of East and West Germany after the Iron Curtain disintegrated. But President Frank-Walter Steinmeier was compelled to call for vigilance against neo-Nazis.
They want another state, an authoritative state that aggressively excludes parts of society. They see themselves as part of a tradition that this republic doesn't stand for and that has nothing to do with our democracy.
Hours after that speech, outside Hamburg synagogue, a man in military fatigues attacked a Jewish student with a shovel, inflicting grave head injuries. Germany's anti-Semitism czar, Felix Klein.
Nobody can deny the deadly dimension of anti-Semitism and right-wing extremism in Germany anymore. Right-wing extremism is a big threat of democracy in Germany.
The German police are not immune either. Confidence in the police was rocked after 30 officers were suspended for sharing extreme material in online chat groups that included images of Adolf Hitler and depictions of a refugee in a gas chamber. Heike Kleffner leads a non-profit that supports victims of right-wing violence. She is one of hundreds of people named on right-wing death lists.
We have police officers who supply right-wing terror networks with information from police database on political enemies. And we have police officers who spread anti-Semitic and National Socialist propaganda.
Ferhat Koçak, a left-wing politician with Turkish heritage, almost lost his life because of police collusion or negligence. A police inquiry admitted that officers knew neo-Nazis were planning an arson attack on Koçak, but failed to inform him.
The fire spread to the house, and it was luck that we survived with my family. I get a lot of messages with death threats. And I'm not the only one, so a lot of friends also get these death threats, but they always say we wait for the right time to kill you.
The government insists that 99% of police officers are anchored in the law and only a minority are rotten, a view echoed by Berlin police spokesman Thilo Kaulblitz.
For us as Polizistinnen und Polizisten,
For us as police officers, it hurts. It hurts because we join this profession with a certain idealism, and we stand firmly on the ground of our liberal democratic constitution. And if there are people within our ranks who call themselves police officers, but who do not share our common understanding and our oath, then it hurts us no end.
Despite official admissions of culpability from both military and the police, activists believe there is not enough transparency.
We have a lot of Nazis in authorities, and it is important to start to change this now.
One thing that absolutely needs to happen is an independent scientific research on the percentage of hardcore racists and anti-Semites within the German police force.
Germany's main concern is the neo-Nazis' ambition to launch a violent uprising one day in the future.
This situation is precisely our chance to excite people again for a real alternative, to completely change the system so that the German people can once again live in a country worth living in.
Although he doesn't believe the Third Reich could be resurrected, President Steinmeier warned against complacency.
The colors of this democratic history are the colors black, red, and gold, the colors of unity, justice, and freedom. We will not allow them to be driven away, misused, or appropriated.
The anniversary celebrations culminated at the Brandenburg Gate that once marked the division between East and West. Beneath its neo-Nazi cloud, Germany is a long way from being truly united. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant in Berlin.
The American barn is a cultural icon, but one that is disappearing fast. In Port Austin, Michigan, an art project aims to draw attention to these structures and maybe, along the way, save some of them. Jeffrey Brown has this report as part of our American Creators series and ongoing arts and culture coverage, Canvas.
What looks like a giant arc rises out of acres of surrounding soybean fields.
People who drive by, their initial confusion starts with, that's a weird-shaped barn.
A few miles away, what seems a working barn, in reality has a slice cut out of it.
So from this angle, you can start to actually see that the slice is not just a cut on the face. It instead actually turns into a whole space itself.
And on one side of this barn, a painting of a pigeon. On the other, a mural styled after the famous American Gothic by Grant Wood, with a twist. They're wearing gas masks.
Let them come and do this to my
I'm
bar.
So curious.
On this day, passersby had a chance to ask artist Steve and Dorota Coy what it means.
I was thinking like it was the farmers that sold out to big farming companies with the chemicals and sold out the farm.
It's multi-layered, but yeah, that is that is the point. That is an art project that my wife and I started, and so we thought that we would critique corporate culture and corporate society, right?
For me, it's always been about the people, you know? I love the people up here. I love the people of Detroit.
And this project, the idea of Jim Boyle, is a meeting of the two. Boyle grew up here in Port Austin at the tip of the thumb of Michigan. He's lived and worked in Detroit for decades, but has strong ties to rural life here.
Why are these structures going away? It's really complicated. Sometimes they're not utilitarian anymore, and the farm equipment doesn't fit. Sometimes it's more of the smaller farms getting swallowed up by larger farms. So what are the economic implications? And Detroiters can relate with all of those.
The city is 120 miles away. And after Boyle cobbled together grants and private donations, he launched the project in 2013 with Detroit-based artists.
I think a lot of people ask the question, why are you painting on an old barn that's going to fall down?
And we barely had an answer for that.
Dorota and Steve Coy's work typically focuses on deserted urban spaces. But what's happening in Detroit, even a crumbling factory around the corner from their studio, has similarities to economic and other changes in rural Michigan.
The parallels are so strong. I mean, it's almost like the same force is causing both of those things to happen.
and we're not having the broader conversation about why those things are impacting both of us. Maybe rather we're looking at each other to kind of point the finger.
We don't want to just show up in the community and be like, here's an art piece that we've created for you guys. Like, I think there was a dialogue. So between the community and making sure that they would be proud and behind of what we were putting up.
Dairy farmer Mark Zeal owns the still operating barn and takes real pride in the transformation.
Every once in a while I'll stop in and talk to the people who take pictures of it, and they says, boy, you know, that's fading a little bit. Is there anything you can do to redo that, you know? I could probably drum up some cash to get it done.
And for the local community, these art barns are a potential jumping off point. The head of economic development for Huron County, Carl Osentoski, sees room for a thriving art scene.
From our perspective, it's a renewable resource. Artists will always be making new art. People will want to either buy that or view that art, and it's a kind of a cycle that can self-sustain over time.
It was very important for me to respect the place. How to keep the iconic form of the barn was very important.
Katie Newell is a Detroit-based architect and artist whose work deals with the concepts of light and dark. Her barn is an engineering feat. Cutting a slice through it required an enormous amount of shoring up on the inside to make it hold.
I was interested in figuring out how to in a way make sort of a subtraction in the barn that instead was adding a large opening for the sky. So what was changing in the barn, and in essence what might be delicate or impermanent in this project, is actually just the constantly changing sky, the seasons. Sunsets, very dramatic here.
But you're doing that by subtracting, as you say, by sort of cutting into it. But that also adds to the structure somehow?
So you're right, that the subtraction of sort of making a void and a big light well also became an addition of making a new space. And the barn, in essence, has literally been split into two barns at that moment.
Detroit sculptor Scott Hawking did something else with his barn. He tore it down.
Taking a barn that already exists, that's kind of decaying, dilapidated, and rebuilding it as something else, just so that as people driving down the road might slow down and have a moment of, what the hell is that? What's going on with that barn?
Hawking reused the old boards to build his large barn boat. And from the inside, there's an entirely different feeling.
In my mind, there's almost something cathedral-like about it. It's like the light coming through windows. There's something very beautiful when the sun goes down. The sun kind of sets and gleams through these holes. So trying to create something that I saw in actual old barns by making gaps in between the boards.
The artist, All Friends in Detroit, recently got together here for the first time. The hope is that more art barns will follow. Art for Michigan's rural thumb, and a creative way to draw attention to these imperiled icons of the American landscape. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Thank you, Jeffrey Brown, taking us places we don't get to see very often. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.